I didn't participate. Never went to like prom. Like went to mom prom.
What's mom prom?
You go with your mom.
Wait, like, what?
Like, you take your mom to the dance. You guys don't do like
what?
Yeah,
that's no, that did not make
like
it
a daddy daughter dance. But
basically, but
with moms, yeah, they had that in Omaha.
They had that at my school. Yeah,
moms.
So mom, everyone did it.
Yeah, I mean, my mom made me do it.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast. Your nothing gets crossed out of weekly culture chat. I'm John Caramonica, and I am the critic.
I'm Joe Coscarelli, and I am the reporter.
And I'm Connor Oberst, and I'm on podcast.
Hey!
Nailed it.
Big day.
Big day.
Big day on podcast.
Thanks
big
for
day
me.
In our day. Shared personal history. And I'm going to get to that, but yeah. I'm just going to do a quick sum up of you and your career.
A pricey.
Yeah. Connor Oberst is a singer-songwriter, best known for his work in Bright Eyes, one of the most ambitious and singular bands of the 2000s. Since the age of 12, you've been writing and recording music. Beginning in the late 90s, Bright Eyes released albums like Fevers and Mirrors. Lifted. You started Saddle Creek Records with your brother, some mm-hmm. friends. You were instrumental in making Omaha, Nebraska the center of independent music for a while, a very important scene and record label. And in the decades since, you've been in bands like Better Oblivion Community Center. Desaparecidos, a personal favorite of mine. You've released albums as Connor Oberst?
Yeah, you're doing great.
Okay, all right. And most recently, you've been playing anniversary shows for the double release that we're now celebrating the 21st anniversary of. I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning. And Digital Ash in a Digital Urn from 2005. Blood, another century spent pointing guns at anything. And as I alluded to at the beginning, John and I come at these albums from different places, but I think in some ways...
This is really, as with all things on Bobcast, this is Joe's way of underscoring how old I am.
No, but I think in some ways, I don't think we would be in this room together having a podcast if not for these albums in some way. Okay. So
that's probably true.
When it's they came true, out right? in 2005, I was 16 years old. Ish. I was a junior in high school. I was living in Florida. You were the most important songwriter in my life, not named Andre 3000, probably. And
that's good company.
And this was an album, especially Wide Awake, that was so much about New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And it really fed into this idea that I had as a teenager, which is like, if I don't move to New York when I graduate high school, like I'll die. Like I just won't be able to go on. I had to get here. At the same time, John reviewed the albums for Spin. There was an issue with the Killers on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
Double review by John Caramonica, and that I had in my bedroom and probably read like 50 times cover to cover. And here we are.
So first of all, shout out John Dolan for taking a shot and letting the rap guy write the Bright Eyes review. Sorry.
Amazing.
And I just reread it. It does, in fact, as Joe said, sounds like me.
Yeah, 20
years
ago.
That's a relief. That's a relief. Yeah. 21 years ago, I still sounded like myself.
Yeah. When you hear those albums, are you like, sounds like me?
Yes. I think it's kind of like seeing an old picture of yourself or something. You know, you recognize that it's you.
Sure.
But it's, you know.
You feel distant from the content of it in some way?
Yeah, it depends on the song. But, you know, I think it's a little snapshot. But, you know, it's still me.
That was me. It was a weird time.
Yeah.
So you just did these anniversary shows around these albums, performing them each front to back, which not something you'd really done in your career. What was it like for you at first to make the decision to revisit them and then to sort of have the best laid plans go awry?
It took me a while to like come around to it. I guess, you know, probably why it's 21 years and not great 20, but despite the turmoil of the cancellations, I'm still like very happy we did it. I'm like, I actually kind of changed my mind because when I see bands like go on tour and do like, they're going to go on tour and play this one record. And I get it. It's like, you know, if you love that record, sure. There's plenty of bands that love to see a record played, but it'd be hard to do a whole tour like that for me. And we also tried to make it a little bit closer to the true to the recorded material, where normally, like, our band, you know, it's Mike Mogus and Nate Walcott and myself, the three of us stay, but like everyone else rotates in and out. And so we always sort of arrange the songs based off of who's in the band,
who's around,
and what instrumentations we have on the road. And that's just kind of the way we've always done it, but we wanted to try to be faithful to the recording. So that was actually a little different than normal, but people appreciated who liked the music.
Are you going to revisit these albums? Like, will you try to reschedule these shows because you only really pulled off one and a half?
No, there is this like deep feeling of like incompletion where we just like, I would love to. It's kind of like, it's just like, there's a lot of moving parts with because it was two different bands, mm-hmm. two different like live stage.
Right. A lot of
thing. There's costume change for your boys.
So. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. And you came fitted today, which we appreciate.
John, I already called out the Gucci loafers. These are
little
beautiful
crepe wool pants.
I'm about
situation.
To head to Europe. I was like, should I?
This is just kind is of this
like,
a good.
Yeah, like I could,
light wool. This is know, a light wool
I only
pant
wear.
You know, as you know, it's like you got to be ready. You got to be photo ready when you walk out your door these days. You're on camera.
For the Paps.
You're on camera every second of every day.
It's real spill.
So just like be ready. Get
dipped.
You know?
One of the things I was struck by at the show when you were playing Wide Awake was these moments of levity. Like there was families there, toddlers. Like
My family was there.
There was at least two proposals to
I heard about that
first
after
day
the
of
fact,
my life.
But that's amazing.
Yeah, like so much of your music is dark and it's about despair and angst. Like you have this song First Day of My Life, which has a life of its own. I'm wondering like what it's like in the streaming era to have your most popular song by many degrees of magnitude be this like pure little love song.
Yeah,
it's not representative.
It's an outlier of our music for sure.
This is the first day of my life. Swear I was born right in the doorway.
You know, I think with like, you can kind of tell when anyone like goes into a studio like to like make a hit, it's probably not going to work out.
Right.
I think most like hits are like flukes kind of.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And so like, yeah, I think that it was just kind of a fluke.
Another thing I was struck by at the concert was the way certain lines resonated. This is, as I alluded to at the beginning, like a real New York City album, and you could see people go up anytime you made a hyperlocal reference. We were at Forest Hills in Queens. The other lines that really hit were the lines about war, which were written at the time about, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan and especially Iraq, but have a new resonance today.
So when you're asked to fight a war that's over nothing, it's best to join the side that's gonna win.
You've been in the folk tradition, you've worked in the protest song tradition. I wonder how your attitude towards those types of songwriting have differed under President Trump versus at the time under George W. Bush.
It's really hard for me to even articulate the Trump era. Maybe at like some point I'll be able to do it. It's like, it feels so, you know, it's like you can't satirize or whatever, like what's already like a parody, what's already like in like a disgusting, like gross cartoon, you know. It's like, I haven't really found, you know, it's like President Talks to God is that song.
Which is your Bush song.
Yeah.
When the president talks to God, are the conversations brief or long? Does he ask to rape our women's rights and send poor farm kids off to die?
And that, you know, that's not much of a song. It's more of just like a slow bunch of slogans kind of. But it felt like it meant something now. I guess the bar has been lowered to such a degree, like societally and in every kind of aspect of our lives, with the exception of, you know, these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you can have like, you know, just a person at that base level of just like moral decrepitude as Trump be the president of the United States, like when people like start saying, you know, like talk about, you know, so-and-so has a has a scandal or something and people argue about things, it's like, look at who the president is. You know, he's like a con man, like a, has done nothing but like rob the country, like literally, like him and his family and his businesses, like robbing this country in front of our eyes. You know, it's like in the things he says, I'm going to destroy a civilization, mm-hmm. you know, from his telephone and his whatever, you know, it's like, I'm sure he can't type de los gordos with those guys, but you see my point. It's like, it's so absurd that it's,
you find it impossible to write about.
I mean, you know, I'm sure it permeates like everything. All
right. Mm-hmm. Right.
But to write directly towards it is like almost, I found it like almost impossible.
You've tried.
I mean, I've thought about it and I've had plenty of people be like, where's the new president talks to God, or, you know, like that kind of thing. And it's like, I don't know. It's such a just avalanche of just like insanity. And like,
do you think that accounts for the lack of protest music in this moment? I think
people are scared. I mean, I think they've gone out of their way to try to intimidate all of us just on such, I mean, obviously he's like, he just announces it and then they go do it. It's like, you say it and then you send the Justice Department to like prosecute someone. It's just, you don't even have, it's just right before your eyes, you know? So it's like, it's almost like, I don't got to tell you about it.
Right.
Just like, look at it.
You don't feel you have to unearth or put a spotlight on something, because it is the spotlight.
It's like hiding in plain sight.
I just felt a similar, though, sort of disdain and befuddlement from you in the early 2000s, like around the Iraq War, which became like something that you weren't only writing songs about, but that you were talking about on stage and in interviews. And, you know, it was a big part of your life to be a political singer. You know, you stood up against
like a political world. So it's like, you just, I think they're inseparable, like politics and like personal life, you know.
Is there something about youth, though, I guess is what I was getting at, where you were more eager to tackle these untackleable things, whether it was the war in Iraq or Clear Channel and the monopolies around live music and radio, animal rights stuff, protesting anti-immigration bills. Like, did you have more energy for that when you were young?
There's that. I think it's also just like life, you know, there's like peaks and valleys. And sometimes I have more like internal reservoir of energy or something I can like give.
Sure.
And then I've had periods of my life where I just feel very empty and don't, you know what I mean? Like I can't even like keep my own shit together. So it's like hard to be able to like create. And like, even though I want to, I feel the same way about it. It's just, I don't always have, the energy.
Do you feel like those stretches of time that Joe's referring to, you had your shit together more than you did, like in a pure sense, you had your shit together on a personal level?
I know. It was a loaded laugh.
You know, it's always like a rodeo, but I think, you know, I guess my point is like, I've definitely gone, you know, I'm 46 years old and I've been doing this since I was like,
yeah, more than three decades of creating and being out there.
Yeah, so it's there's been a lot of ups and downs, I guess. Is the
sure, easy yeah. way to say I, it. You've mm-hmm. you're alluding to this. You've had a lot of health struggles over the years, and in recent years, you know, you were at the Mayo Clinic for a cyst on your brain. You had vocal issues. You know, you've referred to eating disorders, struggles with sobriety. Like, how much of that do you put on the troubadour lifestyle that you've lived since a teenager versus something more internal, whether biological or emotional or mental health?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, there's like addiction and mental illness on like both sides of my family for like a long time. So there's certainly that. But yeah, I mean, just like being on tour and just doing this for my entire life, basically. I mean, I went to finished high school, but even in high school we'd tour like every summer, and then my parents would like let me go to like South by Southwest, or like anytime we got to do something cool, they would like basically like let me get out of school,
sure,
as long as I like
kept up
my grades and you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, and then I started college. I did like 1 year at University of Nebraska in Omaha, and then the third semester it was like, we had a booking agent at the time, and she was like, basically, if you want to make money, you got to tour when like school's in, because college back then it was like, you could, you know, these colleges would pay like unknown bands, you know, you get one fan at the
at the radio station or the committee. Or, yeah.
And there's a check there for you.
Yeah, like way more than we were getting paid a lot of places. So.
Unsung heroes of the indie rock movement in the 90s and 2000s.
Yeah, the college bookers.
Yeah, a lot of those people keep going into like the industry.
Yeah, they end up somewhere. You know? Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, I was thinking about this a lot in the lead up of this, especially because I was initially experiencing your wave of fame and attention as a young person. Now I'm a grown up, I have a job, I have a child, and I think about what you went through at 13, 14, 15, 16 years old, and I think of it as child stardom. Like, usually we think of that in terms of Hollywood,
Disney. You
know, yeah, Macaulay Culkin, the Disney machine, Lindsay Lohan, or in pure pop, whether it's Michael Jackson or Justin Bieber or Britney Spears.
Mm-hmm.
Now that you have enough space from it, 3 decades, as we talked about, like, do you think of yourself as a former child star?
I mean, definitely everything that was ever written about like me or our bands, you know, forever started with like Wunderkind or, you know, some reference to like how young I was, because I was very young.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I suppose like, I don't know, like niche stardom, you know,
well, sure.
If that's a thing, you know, like the fanzine reading, like record store going.
Yep.
People.
Yeah.
Did other kids around you treat you differently because of this kind of like alt second life that you had?
They honestly did it like in high school. They didn't really know. I just kept my eyes closed.
You're in the cut.
I went to an all boys Jesuit high school, and I just like just went in and just did it. And like, but every night I was hanging with like other friends from other schools and like older kids that played in bands. And you know, I didn't participate, never went to like prom. Like my girlfriends were usually at college, like in college, went to mom prom.
What's mom prom?
You go with your mom.
Wait, what?
Like, you think you take your mom to the dance. You guys don't do like
what?
Yeah.
That did not make
like
it.
Like a daddy daughter dance?
But
with moms?
Yeah,
they had that in Omaha?
They had that at my school, yeah.
Mom,
so my mom, everyone did it?
Yeah. I mean, my mom made me do it, but my brother was in school too. So I think we maybe took turns, but
I'm not up on that at
that's
all.
New. That's new. We don't have that on the East Coast.
Sheepshead. That didn't make it to Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn.
but
Midwest.
Yeah, it really is. So you've spoken a lot, though, I think, from your own personal experience about how dangerous it is, this sort of like objectification of our idols, right? Mm-hmm. This like idea, you know, you say Wunderkind, but people are also constantly talking about your weight, your looks, your paleness, you know, like objectifying you in some ways, male, female, young, old. Like, this is in articles, but this was also in comment sections and blogs and message boards. Like, what was it like to experience that version of you be put through the ringer?
It's a trip. You know, I'll never understand like being a woman and like being objectified in like that way. But, you know, I do understand like being thought of as like a, you know, a commodity or an object, or, you know, the idea where your name becomes like synonymous with this thing that like isn't really you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but then you have to do the labor to keep the name up, even though it's separate from yourself.
Yeah.
You gotta hold you have to hold the line on that.
Yeah. And I don't know. It's hard. I always had a like a self like sabotage streak, I think, in me too. Like, where if anyone likes something, I was like, I'll go do something different. For sure.
You also pretty studiously avoided the internet. Like, that's never been a huge part of your life, I think, in part because as these early internet communities, especially that focus on music, were bubbling up.
I really thought it was going to be a fad when it first came out.
You thought it was like a 5-year thing?
You're like, I'm just going to ignore this until it goes away.
I thought it was going to be a fad.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Like, how early on did you realize, like, not only from your own personal experience of being picked apart in those forums, but like, how early on did you realize like this was not only an unhealthy place for you, but maybe for everyone?
Yeah. I never really like got into like social media stuff. Like, I had like a little private Instagram for a while, for like a few years, and like, but that kind of got like, just like, I was like, oh, I can't like look at everyone's like, and then you feel like, oh, I got to like someone just put a picture of their kid up.
Yeah. You got to like it.
Just like too. It's far too time consuming.
Now I got to be responsible for liking a picture of my friend's kid.
Exactly. And if you don't, you know, but, So I really like, I remember when it like started to be real as far as like the label and like having like the first website and like we could like do mail order. And I mean, it really helped us like Saddle Creek as a label. It put a lot more things at our disposal. And I think we benefited from it in that way, being like a tiny independent label in Omaha.
Totally.
And being able to reach like larger groups of people. I don't want to say I like saw it coming, but I kind of saw it coming.
Right. You were like, you were a canary in the coal mine for like, maybe we shouldn't all be under this exact microscope.
Yeah. It's just not healthy, I think, to like need that validation and that, you know, dopamine hit or whatever people get from that constant, you know, what we know now is like social media, like addiction and shit, you know, it's like, I, you know, thankfully I was very far from anything like that, but I mean, even not paying attention to it, like, you know, affects my life because of, you know, just whatever, but
I think the thing that we're all sort of talking about when we're talking about the internet is like, it kind of encourages a little bit in everybody to maybe overshare and kind of, and you oversharing has been integral to much of your art.
You had an artistic outlet for it.
And so I wonder,
if you hear my songs, you think I'd be like into it.
But there's, so my question being, do you, having been so sort of focused on exposing your vulnerabilities, like, is that part of looking at the something like online sharing and being like, hey guys, chill out a little bit?
What's also, I would say, like a fake version of it, right?
Well,
more
of course,
likely.
Yes, but
songwriting and like making a song for a band, it's like, and like crafting lyrics is like so far from like writing a bunch of trash on the computer. And
I think you're right.
It's like, it's not, they're not really like comparable, really, you know.
But I also wonder, you come from
within the sharing part, kind
sure,
of,
but, right?
But sharing was never really like, I write like obviously about things autobiographical in nature a lot of times, but you know, it's always, that's never been the point of the song to me. Like, you know, the meaning of the line is never like necessarily like in like the pronouns or like I or you or whatever. It's like, it's the rest of the line that like carries the meaning, if you know what I mean. I think I think that the song should be able to withstand that, like, because no one's gonna hear a song the same way. So, like, you say, like, I'm gonna sing about my feelings. It's like the hope is that there's like universality to it.
Sure.
That, you know, or if not, that's fine too. Because I think like self-expression is like such an important thing. Like, and that's kind of the beauty of putting something out into the world. You know, that it might find some sympathetic ears out there, find some people to relate to it, you know.
At the same time, you sort of kept a distance from the music business, right? You grew up in the scene in Omaha doing a lot of DIY stuff. You guys started your own record label. You were idolizing Fugazi and Discord and the punk of the 80s and 90s, and you know, you're working with your friends, and presumably, especially around the time we're talking about, early 2000s, you had a ton of major label interest, I assume, people promising to make you a big, big star. How much of your resistance to that was the scene you came from, the ethos you grew up with, versus self-preservation and knowing that maybe you didn't have the constitution to go to that next huge level that some of your peers did?
I think those are simultaneously true. We were kind of punk rock, like hipstery. You know, we always thought we knew what the best music was. We, you know, like, it was still when there was still like, there was that idea of like, you could like sell out and stuff and like indie rock and all. I mean, all these things are like sort of gone.
Outmoded.
But like, I don't know. But at the time, yes, it did mean a lot to us. And we thought we were like sticking it to the man and all that and having our own label. So that was part of it. And then I think, you know, eventually we did, you know, I've signed a lot of record deals in my life, and we did kind of like cash in. We did like an ex-US deal between these records, the two records in Casadega, and like signed to like Universal, like outside of the United States, so we could stay on Saddle Creek. And that's kind of how we, like Michael Mogus, and I, you know, how we have like houses and our studio and stuff, you know.
That was like your one moment.
Well, that's who gave us like the most. It was still like, it was like 2006, I guess.
Sure.
Like it kind of like slid under the door as it was closing. Right. And, like, and it was funny because they gave us all this money and we like built a studio. And then it was for like two records. And so we made Casadega and they pushed it and like didn't really like do what they wanted to do. And then like 4 years or whatever went by. But we signed, like when you sign contract deals, it's like a record or like an option. Mm-hmm. But we had like a firm thing. So they were firm for two records with like the next money being like more in the first
after
one.
After Casadega.
Yeah. So when we made People's Key and like every, basically it was actually Polydor, which is like an English label. It's basically Universal. Anyway, it's kind of inside baseball.
No,
stuff.
No. But, go ahead.
So we got a bunch of money and then like 4 years later, we, like everyone that we knew like didn't work there anymore.
Yeah, they totally turned
and
then, over.
Like, we turned in the People's Key, and I was like, I was picturing like someone like going like finding the file cabinet and being like,
"Did we sign this band?" Yeah. And, like,
what? Who are these guys? And we owe them what?
Well, there's also a big gap, right? It was like 2007 like and then 2011.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
You know, in that sense, we like robbed the bank. But,
that's awesome. Yeah.
And you never, like from a sort of DIY ideals perspective, you never felt like we're signing to the big bad.
By that point.
Okay, moved on. Okay. Many have not.
No.
Not that many.
Not many had not, I should say, at that time.
Yeah. I mean, I've worked with, like, I was on Nonesuch, which is like part of Warner Brothers, but they're a different sort of thing, and been on Merge, been on a bunch of labels. But yeah, and really, it's about who works on at those places and how much they care about what they're doing, you know? So I think the days of, like, you know, the major label, evil major lit, you know, now it's like it's all
blurred.
We're all subjugated to like the tech yeah, we're thing all, anyway. So
evil is around all of us.
What happened with Saddle Creek? Because you're so closely associated with that label, but a couple years ago you moved to Dead Oceans, mm-hmm. not only for your new music, but for your back catalog. Like what exists between Connor and Saddle Creek? I genuinely don't know and don't know if you've spoken about it before.
Well, basically like It started like with my brother and our friend Ted Stevens, who's still in Cursive, but he was in Span Lullaby for the Working Class, which was like Mogus's band before Bright Eyes. We started the label like cassette tapes, and then we put out this band, Slow Down Virginia, which is like pre-Cursive band. Yep. And yeah, we just all had these bands and started like, you know, it was like 7 inches and then like, you know, CD and then records, and then we would all start touring and like kind of just operating as like a collective. Like I would be on tour with like Faint like records in my van to like sell to kids, even though they weren't even playing.
Right. You were selling other bands from your label at your shows. Yeah.
And that went on and we had a lot of success. And then I don't need to get into all the gruesome details, but basically like money and, you know, people, we didn't have any kind of paperwork. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a mess when it's like a lot of, you know, so essentially like our, you know, one of our friends like kind of ended up with like sole control of the label and the original bands, which were basically like us in Cursive and Faint, all kind of like split. Cause we're like, well, this isn't, cause we had like passed, people have felt like we'd passed up opportunities to like, you know, the Faint had crazy offers, like pre-Killers, like
they were doing, right. Like that the Faint were like a electronic.
They were doing that shit.
Insane. So, that was indie sleaze. Like people think what indie sleaze is something. Like the Faint was actual indie sleaze or and whatever whatever people think that was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's probably some of those people that still are like, why didn't we sign? But at the time, it was like,
we're loyal to Saddle
Creek.
Loyal.
Like, we're not even to the label so much as to each other.
Sure.
You know, and then once we realized it was not that anymore, everyone was just kind of like, shh.
And Saddle Creek they still persists.
And they do. And they I don't want to just like, Rob Nanzel, who owns it, is still a friend of mine. I love him. And I'm, you know, they did a lot of cool stuff separate, you know, Big Thief. Hop Along. I don't know. Yeah. So many great, right? They put out a lot of great music.
Yeah.
And so I'm proud of their success. And I still friends, but yeah, just not working together.
Right. There was too much mess to untangle. Yeah. So you had to start fresh, essentially.
And we finally kind of did it. And then we were doing the deal for the new Right Eyes Records with Dead Oceans. And I had worked with them with Phoebe for the Better Oblivion stuff.
So with Phoebe Bridgers.
So I liked them. And and then we kind of just made sense to move like the whole catalog over there for
consistency purposes.
Yeah.
Do you find like when you like you think of yourself as a catalog artist at this point, when you go out on the road next, are you thinking like I'm here because I'm making new music that I want people to focus on? Or do you think I literally have piles of stuff that I just want to show everybody and be like, remember all of these piles of things? Like, how do you think of yourself when you're out on stage and what you want to present on the road?
Yeah, I mean, that has kind of changed too over time, where I think when we would make a record, we used to like go out and just play like just that.
Yeah.
We would play other songs, but mostly it was like, this is the record. And we still do that, I suppose.
The new album.
Right.
Yeah.
But like when we put out Five Dice All Threes, which was last Bright Eyes record, you know, we played some of those songs, but we also played like a lot of old songs. And it's fun to, since we have so many songs, to kind of change it up. And the band always sort of changes. So there's a certain amount of like rehearsal for, you know, we got to put together.
Everything
like,
is a stuff. Little bit new.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've been doing this your whole life, essentially, as we've discussed. Like, it's hard to imagine you think you've been on a linear incline as a songwriter. Like, when or in what periods do you think you were writing your most potent music? Like, when were you best as a writer and an artist? Like,
that's your guys' job.
But I'm saying, but when in your heart, like, when did you feel, either in real time or looking back, like, oh, these were the moments when I was like, I'm locked the
in my bag.
I mean, those have happened, you know, sporadically, like the whole time. Mm-hmm. I just was in France for like 5 weeks recording some stuff and like had this like magical time and felt like so connected to what we were doing and like all this. So, I mean, like it still happens. I mean, I suppose back around, what coming to mind with these, with the two, with Digital Ash and Digital Learn and I'm Wide Awake It's Morning. I mean, I was writing so much. I mean, that's why it ended up being two albums because it was, you know, I was just writing so many songs.
Sure.
And then the real decision came, you know, they diverted it into like, there were definitely gonna be two albums. And then we sort of decided to put them out on the same day as like a little bit of a stunt, but also like, it was like, this is the music, this is the band. But that was, talking about that, that was the worst. One idea we had that was really bad was what we did normally, but we did the Digital Ash, or sorry, we did the Wide Awake tour, like world tour, and we had just basically played those songs because the band was going to be so different.
Sure.
Into like the switching
two
band.
Different styles.
So so we're like, we'll take the folk band, we'll go do Wide Awake, which we did, and like, you know, it was like everywhere we went, it was like we were like the Beatles or something, you know, I was taking our picture, and like, it was like mayhem, and then like, I went home for like 2 weeks, and we like, switched over and the Faint was our band for the Digital Ash tour. So I like deposed one of the guys in the Faint. Like I remember I brought all my clothes over to his apartment and just threw them in a plastic bin and just dyed them all black. And then I was like, okay, let's go. I'm ready.
Yeah.
And then we went out and we did the Digital Ash tour.
Yeah.
And now that I think about how crazy it was, cause like the records came out like in January or whatever. And a lot of people just got the one record and they see we're coming to town and then show up and just don't see any song.
They're like, what is this?
Totally different band. So
right.
That was maybe not the best.
But now Drake is ripping you off, you know? So just like putting out multiple albums on one day.
Were you inspired by Nelly, who put out Sweat and Suit on the same day? Which is the sweat and Nelly's which is the suit?
That's real.
It's just sweat.
You guys were making, that was a real business flex at the time and sort of the end of the CD era, right?
Yeah.
To drop two albums on one day.
Yeah, it was a little bit of like, look what we can do, but.
You talk about your relationships throughout the years. Basically, everyone you know has been through music in some way or another. Presumably, you've written songs about many of them, family, friends, loved ones, romantic relationships. But then because they're also musicians, they also write songs about you. Yep. Like, what has it been like to be a muse for others? Like, what is it like to hear songs about you, whether it's from Phoebe Bridgers or Maria Taylor from yeah. Azur Ray, like people you've been around your whole life and you guys are trading songs, you know, like what's it like both to be inspired by the people around you and then to hear them be inspired by you?
I mean, it's sweet, you know, it's nice.
Do you recognize yourself in songs that are about you?
I mean, you know, sometimes, but I think, you know, that's kind of part of the deal. It's like if you're hanging out with songwriters,
yeah,
you know, you're kind of fair game, you know. I think, I mean, I definitely like take little observations or little things out of my life that people who hear it will know what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. but maybe not, you know, it's that like little inside jokes basically,
mm-hmm. yeah,
you know. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that it's kind of just what happens when all your friends are songwriters.
No presumption of privacy, you don't yeah. think.
Hey, man, I told you, camera ready when you walk out the door.
That, you mean that in every sense.
Yeah,
in
like,
every way.
It's,
no, that's real. That's, you know? That's actually such an interesting way to put it, because I think so many people do have that presumption of if I have personal intimacy with someone, then they're going to protect my personal intimacy. Right. But if your entire social circle are people who, and I say this not derogatorily yeah. at all, violate personal intimacies for a living, like,
yeah.
does it change the nature of how you interact to your friends who are creative? Are there things that you withhold from people?
I mean, I don't worry about it too much. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, no one wants to hear like a mean song about them or something like that. Yes. That's never happened. Thankfully, that's never happened. So,
is that true? No mean songs about you? There's some mean songs about you. And you've written some mean songs.
Yeah, you know, you just got to give gotta it, you got to take it.
Yeah, it's all fair yeah. game, right? And in the lives of artists.
Yeah. I have a lot of songs that have little, like I said, references that I know make my friends smile,
right.
You know,
you're like, that was a, you'll that was know a, yeah, yeah like, a, and you might be the only one,
yeah, and that was a big part of like growing up with in playing in bands with ever all these friends is like, you know, yeah, you do share that bond and the creativity, and even if it's not something that's like personal in my life, like it's cool when you hear stories of like, oh, you know, that song's about so and so, you know, and little, what do you call that? Factoid?
Yeah.
Or something?
Yeah. Yeah, it's lore is yeah, what we call
lore.
It now.
Lore.
But yeah, it's like Bob and Joan, you know, yeah. it's like, or looking back on, you know, the Beatles writing songs about each other after the, you know, it's yeah, part of rock and roll history.
Yeah. Yesterday's the best thing you ever done, or the only thing
yeah,
you ever done.
Exactly.
That's
yeah.
cold.
How do you sleep, right? That's
yeah,
the,
yeah.
the Lennon song about Paul.
Yeah.
Hey y'all, it's Kyra Blackwell from Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times, and I test mattresses. Today I am testing 7 mattresses, all brand concealed. It just feels like such a daunting endeavor to pick the right mattress. This mattress is very supportive. It's just like very easy to shift positions. We've considered nearly 4 dozen foam, inner spring, and hybrid mattresses. We're looking out for edge support, motion isolation, and firmness levels. We are cross-referencing our data between testers, which includes people of all different shapes, sizes, and sleep preferences. When it came right out the box, it smelled like lavender. I'm not sure how long that'll last. I finished compiling all of my tester surveys. One tester noted the mattress had some give and underlying firmness and support. At Wirecutter, we do the work so you don't have to. For independent product reviews and recommendations for the real world, come visit us at nytimes.com/wirecutter. It feels very squishy, but in a good way.
You're in this moment of celebration. People are experiencing the nostalgia of revisiting these records and seeing you seem happy and healthy and bright. And it wasn't that a couple years ago in 2024, canceled a bunch of tour dates after what you called the near-death experience. Like, I think your body was really breaking down. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like to hit, I don't know if you call it a rock bottom for yourself, but what it was like to know that you needed to regroup and what allowed you to bounce back in this way?
Yeah, I think I didn't like see the light or anything like that, but I just feel like it was very like real. I didn't really feel happy or sad or anything like that. I actually had like the like meanest internal voice being like, haven't you wanted this your whole life? You fucking son of a bitch. You know, like, you know, like, mm-hmm. when I was like fading out, it's like not very, angels and stuff, you know? So I don't know. I guess just.
And you'd heard that before?
No, I mean, I just like, what I'm saying is like, mm-hmm. when I feel like I was really like close to the edge, mm-hmm. I was like, there was nothing good about it. When I like luckily got through that, and then just, yeah, I guess sort of had like.
We're hand talkers too.
Choice to me or whatever. Just like, okay, I could like keep doing what I'm doing and probably be dead really fast. Or I could like change up my style and like try to like stay around and make more things and like just don't be in such a hurry to like life's so short and like
why make it shorter?
Yeah, don't always be so selfish and like think, you know, it's like people need me around, you know, my family needs me around and like a friend, you know, it's like I don't know, it's one of those things that I think people find different reasons to like live for and all that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And I've always, it's been a long life.
What are the things that you think you were doing to hurry that along? You would, we're talking drugs and alcohol at that point.
Yeah, a lot of that. And yeah, my body was just unable to deal with all this stuff.
You were overloading yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Plus the being on the road, we talked about like sort of not living right in the sense of like three square meals and a nice warm bed and all that. How immediately were you able to flip that switch when you made the decision, like, I want to be here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I ended up, we were supposed to play at the Tompkins Square. It was the day before our record was coming out. Early that morning is like when I went to the hospital. And yeah, I was like, the record before, it's probably being cursed. It's like, the record before is like, down in the weeds, it's like 2020. We're all like first label or first record on Dead Oceans, like another classic, like big push. That's the thing is like they don't tell you this, but you know, as you make more records, like every time you hear like this is the one, you know,
we're going all out.
I've been told that like so many times in my life, like this is gonna change, you know, whatever. Yeah. But so the pandemic, so I derailed that, and then I derailed the next one, and then I got home and everyone was like, we basically were doing some shows around the record and then we're going to go on the real long tour in 2025. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was conversations obviously with everyone and I was just like, you know, do you need more time? Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I want to go. Mm-hmm. Like, I need something to like motivate and like focus on. So that's what we did.
So you went back on the road, essentially. You were like, you took your time.
Yeah, that was in like September, and then we played again in like January.
And in that stretch, that winter, you were able to get yourself right?
Yeah, I mean, you know. but yeah. I mean,
almost.
I got like, yeah, and there was a lot of people that didn't think we could do it. And I'm really proud of like all the shows we played that year. I think the band was like smoking, and it was like, you know, it's... whatever, you know, you get like a reputation, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know,
you feel like you have a reputation.
I mean, just like, you know, if you like, whatever, canceling shows.
Yeah.
Was it important to you to defeat that caricature of yourself or maybe that true version of yourself, but that was isolated in low moments?
Yeah. I mean, everyone remembers the show you walked out on, but they don't remember the like 1,000 shows that you played great. Right. You know?
And we do this to so many of our legends, I feel like, often female artists. I think of Lauryn Hill, I think of Fiona Apple, I think of Sean Marshall, Cat Power, you know, these people who are essentially dared to screw up because people are sort of waiting for them to lose it on stage. And we love their fragility in their music. And then maybe we are less accepting of it in the human being that has to stand there when people have paid money for tickets or whatever it is. Yeah. Like, do you feel kinship with those artists who have been through that particular version of fame and music?
Absolutely. And it's a lonely place to be when you feel like everything is counting on you, but like whatever your state of mind or your physical state is just not in a good place. And it's just like this compounded of like shame and like letting everyone down and like losing money and like blah, 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 you know? And so it's never a happy thing. But yeah, people have it worse than me in that regard. You know, my star is low in the sky, you know?
I mean, I don't know if that's true.
I actually don't know if I would say it that way.
Yeah. But. I mean, it's great. I'm not complaining.
No, of course. Yeah. Was there one thing that really helped you through that period, whether it was diet or exercise or magic potion routine they sell on kind, the internet? Yeah. I don't know. Like what, like, yeah, routine or songwriting or a person, like what got you through?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like the motivation to get healthy enough to travel was like a big motivator. Cause I was just like, everyone put so much work into this and like, you know, I hate letting my friends down, you know?
That's how it feels to you. It's letting your friends down. It's not simply letting the fans down or the business partners or whatever. It's friends.
Yeah.
Because you're still with friends.
It's more than that. And then like, you know, you have to keep in mind like that every, you know, I think I get wrapped up in my own head or my own like things that, you know, you forget how much what you do ripples through and affects other people, you know, and you might not give a shit about yourself, but I'm lucky enough to have like tons of people that like love me and like support me and
actual people who know you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's how I got through it. I guess that's probably the easiest answer. Everyone always comes and rallies for me. Like the true ones.
You talk about coming out of the dark period in part because you have these like tangible people in your life, people you've known for decades, I imagine, who are real and are looking at you and saying either you need help, we want to help, you need to help us. Like,
absolutely.
We have a tether here. You've also been on the receiving end of some tough things over the course of your career from people who did not know you personally, but were speaking like they did.
Yeah.
You had a false accusation leveled against you. You had this thing in 2024 with the bookkeeping guy. Tour agent guy.
Talking about your health. Yeah.
And there, I think for many people in the world who don't know you, those things can carry more weight than you knowing what the actual relationships with your real.
Absolutely.
And if we can tie this back to the beginning of the conversation about the avatar of yourself versus Connor, the individual.
Yeah.
Are those moments where it's hard for you to maintain the distance between those two? Because do those things, when people are speaking about you in this false or unknowing way, does that force you to reckon with the avatar to be like, actually, I got to show up and speak for my, I have to.
Yeah.
What is that experience like?
I mean, yeah, when you have to, whatever, like put out a statement and, you know, anything like that, it's just like.
Like clear your name.
Yeah. There's that. I mean, that whole thing was just a whole nother nightmarish, surreal. Like this can't be real. This is like, you know, talk about like hating the internet.
This for people who don't know, a false rape accusation that stemmed from a comment section on a website and then ballooned into something nuts.
Yeah.
And was eventually retracted by the alleged individual.
Yeah. This person, you know, I think thought they were like, you know, just kind of living in an imaginary place where they're getting like feedback from people on like a comment section about, you know, whatever. And then it kind of, our super fandom, like web boards, you know, took it anyway. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it's like real people. Are like,
it was like national news, international news.
Yeah, which is like, and then, I mean, that absolutely took like years off my life. Yeah.
Was that sort of the beginning of this dark period for you?
I think it definitely sent me on a darker way down the worst path. Yeah, absolutely. And like, just, you know, as far as like not being like, I've put all this myself, all this music into the world. And I've, you know, I've lived this whole life. I know all these people, and the fact that like something like completely false on the internet
right.
can like become into a real thing.
I mean, it can
like,
overshadow everything
it's
I've
like
done.
A weird monster. It's like a crazy like monster. That's like, it's like a, you know, it's like, an invisible thing like attacking you, you know,
and again, it's like, and also for many people it is you. That's why I'm saying like the avatar becomes the real self, and then you as the human have to be like, wait a minute, like I've got to go and let me
that's why
correct
like,
this
I mean, and I've had to come with to peace with like just no one's gonna know you, you know, and you can't know everybody, you know, and the people that know you, that's what matters. And I love connecting with people, and I love, you know, see, you know, but yeah, I mean, it's going back to like being famous. It's like, yeah, you know, there's the whole thing about like, what is this person's motivation? You know, there's those kind of things, but I have like a pretty, I feel like I have a pretty good radar for that. Like, I might get like duped for like a little amount of time.
People show their true selves. Exactly, the mask slips.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you've probably had some version of that spidey sense since you were 15 years old.
Yeah. And I do have friends and artist types that don't have that good radar. And then they'll just get like sucked into like crazy, bizarre relationships. Get a manager that like controls, or you know, like just all versions of that. And that's sad, because a lot of times those people are just so sweet that it's hard for them to be like
too trusting.
Too trusting. They want to take people at the face value. And I do too. But it's, you know, fool me once kind of thing.
You've been through enough.
And it's like when people, you know, someone's like, oh, like, I don't like your record. It's like, who cares? You know, it's like, I've had the worst things said about me. So there's really nothing you could say to me that would like,
A bad review is nothing compared to
nothing.
What you've seen.
And it's like, and I've seen the horror of the mob, like the invisible mob, and like felt the fucking stones like hitting me, you know? So it's like, I'm kind of like, you know, impenetrable.
You feel indestructible?
A little bit. I'm not scared of it.
Yeah, you're like, you haven't got me yet, you know? Like, here I am.
Yeah. I figure just, you know, do your thing and you'll be king kind of vibe.
There you go.
Yeah.
Wow. New one. I like
Bob
that.
Bob Dylan, actually.
Yeah.
That's a Bob Dylan lyric?
Yeah.
New one for John.
Yeah.
Just do your thing. You'll be king. If dogs run free.
You mentioned recording in France recently and feeling like you were buzzing around your songwriting again, your music. Is that a Bright Eyes album? Is that a Conor Oberst album? Is that something yet to be named?
Unclear.
It is a project. I'm not at liberty to discuss it currently, but
good answer.
No, it's
well phrased. Not a lot of people know
how to talk about
how
that.
To not answer a question.
But no, it was I'll tell you, we recorded at this studio called La Frette outside of Paris, and I was there for 5 weeks. And
that's not the Brad Pitt studio, is it?
No, although someone else asked me that, and I didn't know he had a studio.
He owns a studio in France. I don't know. I've heard it's amazing.
And also owns an excellent cashmere line.
I love some cashmere.
Just throwing that out there. Great stuff.
Yeah, so but this place is amazing. And the guy who owns, it's like in a house. So you sleep there. You stay there. There's like a cook that cooks for you. And then studio's in the basement. And just this magical, like, French vortex. And the guy that owns it, who's owned it since like the 80s, his name Olivier, he's like 78 years old. He's like one of the coolest people. Like I feel like just apart from the music, becoming like friends with him.
Like, worth it. You're like, that we're gonna, we're gonna go make podcasts there?
Yeah, let's go live podcast at La Frette, you say?
La Frette.
All right, La Frette, we're pulling up.
Can we afford it? What's the rate? Like?
You guys, I can put in a good word for y'all.
Right. We'll get the Bright Eyes right.
Yeah.
Let's hit a couple questions in our podcast lightning round. There's 52 cards in the deck. They correspond to some pre-written questions that John has on his computer. Some are light, some are heavy, some are fun, some are less fun.
Okay.
Let's see where fate takes you.
Yeah, I just jinxed myself. I'm scared of anything. It's in this card. Okay, so I got the King of Hearts.
There you go.
You're
King
last.
First of all,
I mean, incredible poll.
Yeah,
incredible. We're getting first some poll. Good polls lately.
Connor Overs, King of Hearts.
You'll be king. I just said, tell my king. We didn't plan that, guys.
You're going to laugh, but no my computer here. Just died. Unbelievable. Great timing. So Joe will read the questions. Okay.
Where do your best ideas come to you?
Usually in looking out a window, moving windows, like tour bus windows,
van life,
but also just like skyline, just window of my house. Mm-hmm. I think all my songs that come from daydreaming, basically. So
they sound like daydreams.
That's what I have to set aside time to do that. Like people are like, do you set aside time to write certain part of the day? It's like, no, I just need to like have my space, my current world set up at least for a time in a way that allows for daydreaming, because I think that's where the songs come from.
And what is it about a window? Is it sort of the sort of sense of possibility, like kind of in sort inside outside thing?
I mean, just yeah, I guess like what I at least sort of the style I do is like observational. Mm-hmm. You know, I like keep my ears and my eyes open for any little moment that I find interesting and kind of put it in the back pocket and then to be used in a song maybe or maybe mm-hmm. not. And then, you know, all those things go in there and then like they kind of synthesize and come out as a song, you know?
Later.
Yeah. There's like a delay for sure between right. like experience and like song.
Yeah.
I think.
Cool. Pull another card.
Can I do the rest of the cards? I feel like I want to do something.
Also right. easier with the microphone.
Four clubs, baby. You can't say Knicks and four anymore, right?
No.
Five.
Four. I mean, four
if
clubs.
You're delusional, you yeah. can.
What did you inherit from your parents?
I guess like they're both really good. I'm not saying I always live up to it. They're very good people. They care. They're loving. They're generous. They, my dad's the kind of person that would like do anything for like anybody, stranger on the street, blah, blah, blah. Like super polite Midwestern, just like person that.
I can
like,
tell from the times you mentioned them, you yeah. just have a real pure yeah, fondness for your parents. For
them, yeah. Yeah. I love them. Yeah. So I had two older brothers. My dad was a musician, not for a job, but played in like cover bands for like extra money and stuff. And my oldest brother, Maddie, was played in bands. And yeah, so I think that love of music and the, you know, there was guitars in the house and like amplifiers. And so I was very lucky to have all that stuff just right at hand. And like, again, like older friends that played music that like let me tag along, you know, that was got an early start, head start program.
For sure.
All right.
Okay. King of clubs.
Wow. That's King of DIY clubs, perhaps.
Hey. I knew I liked this guy.
King of Hearts.
King of DIY clubs.
Come on, we're just doing it. We're I think this here. Whole interview has answered this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I want to see your face. Has becoming successful made you want more or less fame?
Less.
Moving on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty one-word answer. Yeah. All right.
But I'd love to play like bigger shows, and
really,
and I'd love to have more money to put on yeah. bigger.
Funny how those things seem to be at odds with each other.
Have you ever played the Garden?
I've never played there.
We just saw there. We just saw there. Did you go to that? You were there. Yeah, we were there too. Yeah,
amazing. It was funny when you were talking earlier about your parents and their political leanings. I was thinking about what Phoebe said. Yeah, it was she's like, does anyone have conservative parents?
Yeah.
And she was like, congratulations to you. Like, yeah. I didn't have to do that because my dad did that work for me.
Totally. I mean, I think so much, a lot of people are fueled by like rebellion from their like home life.
Yeah.
And or that, or just have a terrible home life and have to escape. But
I don't want to put this on you, Shira, if you're listening. If you do Lifted, you can play in Madison Square Garden.
Right? I'll have you talk to my booking agent.
All right. Well, give him my number.
Feel street team for us. You got to go hand out flyers.
Give him my number.
All right. What was the card you just picked?
Five of spades.
Five of spades, and then we'll do one more. Yeah, you got you got four. How's your hand looking?
I got four.
You got two kings. You got a pair of kings. There you go.
Nails.
Do you know tricks? You do card tricks?
No, I was just showing you my nails.
I'm going to get to the nails. Yeah. I'm getting there.
We'll talk about the nails while we eat a snack.
Yeah.
What do you do when you can't fall asleep?
Well, every night I listen to like audiobooks while I sleep, like in my ear.
Oh, the whole night.
The whole night.
Earphones?
Like Tolstoy, War and Peace, because it's got to go through the whole night?
I have to. It's kind of weird. There has to be like definitely not. It's like nonfiction, and like I like them to be long, like so I can sit as long as I stay asleep. So like 10, 12 hours, but then just listen to them to like, and I feel like the person's voice reading it. And listen to it just, you know.
On loop.
And then, like, for weeks. And then, like.
Same book.
Wow. Or switch one out. Go between, you know, between ones. But, like.
Wow.
You know.
Never heard this.
Like. And so, it can't be anything, like, too upsetting. Because, it needs to be, like, you know. I like it to be interesting, but not too interesting that it keeps me up.
You'll catch little bits of it.
Exactly. So, I have, like, weird knowledge of, like. Architecture and
but like only like certain, page 73 like, only
exactly just something I like heard. I'm like, I know I've heard that phrase.
Do you have a favorite voiceover reader? Like, is there like someone where you're like every time
I'll listen to anything that he does. Like
Bill Wilson reads? That's my guy.
You guys know like Bill Bryson? He's kind of like a travel
Yeah. He reads his own stuff. And you like the voice.
I like
bang with Bill Bryson.
Hi, I'm Bill Bryson.
You know, he's got one like Notes from a Small Island about like living in England and like one about like Australia. And he's got a lot of great books.
Wow. This is, I feel like I really learned something about
it. I'm super into it. We have one more?
Let's do one more.
Okay.
That's a great answer.
Right. Six of Diamonds.
What instantly puts you in a bad mood and what can instantly take you out of one?
Petra, my dog, can take me out of one.
Mm-hmm. What kind of dog?
She's like a scruffy. Actually, Phoebe gave her to me for Christmas 2020.
Amazing.
She's like, when we got her, she was real little, but she's like this big. She's like a terrier mix. So a real scruffy face.
Gifting someone a dog is really intense.
Yeah.
It's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of homework.
Well, it was like a friend of the family and the dog, her mom was like house sitting the dog. And like, I was over there and I was just like, they're giving it, telling me that the family that had it couldn't keep her. And I was like, well, if anyone ever wants, you know, just said it. Like, if anyone need a home. And then some time passed and then it was Christmas. And then
just showed up at your doorstep.
And
just
said Petra.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But what puts you in the bad mood that Petra needs to take you out of?
Oh, the news, I guess.
Yeah.
Welcome to the New York Times.
Yeah, I know. I have the New York Times app, and
Thank you for paying. You're part of this set. Yeah. We appreciate that.
So I got to keep the cup.
You can definitely take my
guy. Dog, we got lighters. Whatever you want.
We'll give you a Times cup. We'll give you a lighters,
stickers, whatever you want.
Sticker. You would get a full pack.
Yeah.
Let's eat a snack.
Let's do it.
Every episode of Popcast ends with a snack test. Connor Oberst walked over to our snack table. We call it a pantry, but it's a table.
For now, it's a table.
And was immediately drawn to this beautiful pink and yellow sweet drumstick jelly, milk and strawberry flavored Asian snack.
Did I buy this?
Yeah, John, where did you pull those from?
You toss it to me real quick because I want to see.
I'm going to go ahead and say it's Korean.
I mean, if that is true, then I bought it in Korea.
Nice.
So that would do. I'm going to go ahead and say yes, I bought this.
Okay. What is your snack life like? Because John and I are really into junk food, hence that we make all our guests eat a snack with us.
I like candy.
Okay.
And ice cream.
Yeah, that was good.
What's your go-to ice cream?
Can I just say, I really believe you. I really believe you.
Reese's Pieces actually are like kind of like
class. That's your go-to.
I find myself like, I bought some yesterday.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I have a box of
it's not chocolate. It's like its own flavor.
It's
not chocolate. It's not peanut butter.
It's some third thing. Satisfying crack.
Yeah.
Like when you crack the shell, better than an M&M.
Oh, yeah. Way better.
Better than an M&M. They figured it out.
How do you pronounce Eminem?
Eminem.
Eminem.
How are you supposed to pronounce it?
I emphasize the first M.
Eminem?
Yeah.
Eminem? How does Eminem pronounce it?
Dog.
Eminem.
What are you talking about? Stop.
I've never heard anyone say it that way. I mean, I've heard people say the rapper that way.
Excuse you.
Well, can I tell you why I picked it?
Yeah.
Okay. I picked it because I am a musician. And it said drumstick.
Stop.
And I thought that would be a perfect segue.
How are you on the drums?
I'm not bad. I played drums in a band like in high school for a minute.
Okay.
You know, I can keep a beat, but I wouldn't hire myself to play drums or anything like that.
The name of a band that nobody knows or remembers you were in. I feel like you've been in so many bands.
Yeah, like, bands. The band I played drums in was called Park Ave.
Okay.
And it was like some of the ladies that were in Tilly and the Wall, if you remember that band.
Yeah.
Yes.
And me and Clark, who's the drummer, who's actually playing with us at the show. Mm-hmm. Although he didn't really get to do his whole thing. But
Park Ave exists, so I remember Park Ave. What's a band that you had for two practices?
When I was married, and Karina, who's still like one of my best friends, we had a band called Dolores Diaz and the Standby Club.
Nice.
And she was like the lead singer, and it was like mostly like country covers. Mm-hmm. And we actually made a 12-inch record.
Okay.
But
that commercially released.
Sort of. We made like 300 copies or
fans
so.
It's on Discogs? Are you dragging down? Someone's got it?
What were you covering?
We did like... let's see, Tammy Wynette.
Mm-hmm. George Jones.
Yeah. Man, we did a lot of them.
Sounds great.
We're gonna fight. We're gonna
land. Don't come home with drinking.
Karina
has a good voice.
She's from Mexico and she's got a great voice. Kind of has like a little accent, which is pretty dope.
We're going to track that down. Yeah. We're going to start taking it, and then we're going to rate the snack.
For the record, I picked it because of the...
Because of the name.
Because of the name and because I think it's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It is beautiful.
I will say like gummy candy was never my...
Your wave.
When we were kids, my brother Justin liked like the fruity like Skittle or, you know, all those kind of stuff. And I was like chocolate. Uh-huh. But it's great because Halloween, you got your pillowcase.
Right. You guys trade.
Come home, pour it all on the table,
and then grab what you like.
Start making the trades.
Start bartering.
Let Joe grab. So I do want to talk just briefly.
Supposed to wait?
No, that's fine. I do want to talk about clothes real quick. You came in.
These are a little stale. They're not quite expired, yet. They expire in August.
Yeah, soften up. Put a little slime on it. You'd be all right.
I just got to relax.
All right. So you got the Gucci loafers on. You got a Needles track jacket on in the Princeton colors. You got some, what are these, crepe wool trousers? What's happening with the trousers?
These are Lori, you know how we say it? It's a French, it's like linen. I feel it.
I need some linen. I'm in the market for some linen. John, could I rock these pants?
Yes. I'd like to see you in those pants.
Okay.
Talk to me just a little about style, getting fitted. You sort of joking about being camera ready at all times.
Yeah.
And obviously you knew you were going to be on camera today, but like,
this is the hardest candy to ever have a conversation while chewing.
this is an outfit built with some intention.
Yeah, I think like
you do that every day.
I mean, not every day, but
it is not edible.
It more than I thought.
Soften it up. Let it marinate.
It's like a nice mild flavor.
Yeah, that's
what I'm saying. Whatever the opposite of ASMR is.
Talking with your mouth.
No, like, think of it as a lozenge.
I love to think of my candy as a lozenge.
You're a zin.
Yeah, yeah, literally.
That's you ever zin? You're zinning? Are you zinning right now?
I was trying not, I've been trying not to smoke as much for singing. So I was zinning, at rehearsal. It's all right, but I really like to smoke. The nicotine is kind of...
Yeah.
Well, you dress with intention every day, or many days.
Oh, yeah. I like to... I mean, I've always liked clothes, and, you know, when we were growing up, we'd, like, thrift, and, like, you know, try to look as cool as you can look. Probably slowly over the last, like, decade, I've, like... since I stopped spending so much money on, like, drugs, I was like, I got all this extra cash, so...
Great way to spend it.
Amazing. That's actually why John has so many pairs of shoes, because he never drank or did drugs.
Yeah, that's true. All my money goes to clothes. All my money goes to Louis Vuitton.
Little dopamine hit.
Oh, sure, yeah.
When you put big the credit card hit. In, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Feel like a goddamn American right there. Cha-ching.
Isn't it nice?
tap to pay.
Man, this is actually the, I had not taken the subway. How long have you been able to use your card?
Like you, like pretty, like 10 years.
Yeah, like, I only started literally last year.
You held out
yeah.
until they got rid of all of the cards.
You literally, yeah, no, I was like the last Metro card.
No,
guy.
It's like, I mean, it's but like yeah. COVID-ish.
It's very smooth.
Yeah. You do your phone too. Do your phone. Yeah. Just tap the phone. Yeah. Unbelievable.
No, I haven't thought about, I haven't paid for the subway in years because it doesn't count when it comes off your phone.
Yeah, it's not real money. I mean, it's not real. What are we ranking this snack?
All right, the flavor is good. The texture, I can't hold the texture against the Sweet Drumstick Jelly Corporation because I feel like this is not how it's intended to feel.
You think that it was softer when I bought it?
Yes, I do. I do. Flavor's good. Subtle. Strawberry and milk. I don't really taste strawberry milk. I don't know. What would you give it out of 10? Yeah.
I like it. I think I like it because it's not crazy sweet.
Yeah, it's not that sweet.
And I didn't mind the texture.
Okay.
It's a little like,
it's tough for conversation.
Yeah, I guess like, I guess it's like akin to like taffy.
Yeah.
I suppose.
As in, again, think of it as a lozenge that degrades to taffy.
I mean, I think ideally it would be like a high chew texture.
I know, but you think everything ideally should be a high chew texture.
I do. I love.
Because there's sometimes when they're too, like, what's the ones, the malt one or the ones you get at the movie theater? The really hard ones to chew.
Milk duds.
Milk duds.
Oh, yeah.
Milk duds drive me crazy because I'm
stuck in your teeth.
Yeah. I feel like I'm going to pull a tooth out.
Yeah.
No, but you don't feel that with this. I feel like it's softening. It's almost like
you got to hold it in your palm for 10 minutes.
Sweat it up.
No, but you know, this feels like, I mean, I don't want to over-index here, but I do feel like if the dentist was ever going to give you a jaw strengthening and tooth strengthening candy, I'm inventing new forms of dentistry. If they were ever going to be like, you know what, chew on this for 5 minutes a day.
And then your jaw will work
better. Boost your dental strength, boost your jaw strength.
Yeah.
It's not too sweet.
Right. We're going to check with some professionals.
The American Dental Association, if you're watching, tap in. Look. I'm with you. I'm not that averse to the chewiness of it. I think it's okay. Let it sit. Let it soften. It's a 7.
Right.
Second one is even better.
Yeah.
The second time I took
it.
Out of 10?
Out of 10?
Yeah.
However you want
to
do it.
I mean, I was going to say, there's vastly superior snacks to this. No offense to.
Yeah. No, they're doing great, though.
So
they're doing their thing.
It's definitely over 5.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give it a 6.
Okay. I was going to say 5. Right down the middle. It's like, I'm not mad. It's impractical.
Maybe it's practical for the wrong thing.
It's certainly impractical for you to do the outro of the show.
Like jaw training, chew.
You want me to handle the goodbyes?
You know what it is? It's for looks maxing.
Oh, yeah. You don't have to chisel yourself.
That's what I'm saying. Just chew these for 20 minutes a day?
Yeah. That would take off.
You'd be snatched if you have these. You'll be absolutely snatched. Incredible conversation. Connor Oberst.
I'm going to do it because you got your mouth full still. That is our show. Every episode of podcast is at nytimes.com.
Can I just say thank you to you guys for having me.
Thank you for being here.
Appreciate it.
You're really game and down. And we appreciate
it. Nice talking to you.
It's a pleasure. As I've expressed throughout this conversation, I've been listening to your music for a very long time. And I honestly never thought that we would do this, but here we are.
For listening.
Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, all the places you won't find Connor Oberst, you will find Popcast at Popcast, nytimes.com/Popcast, Popcast at nytimes.com.
That candy has you so twisted that you're doing everything out of order.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. I'm in charge
and
now.
Subscribe.
I'm the captain now. That's our show.
Knicks and five.
By the time this comes out, the Knicks will have either won or lost the championship. We'll go from there.